Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to The Shift, the podcast that aims to tell the no-holds-barred truth about being a woman post-40. Created and hosted by me, journalist and author Sam Baker. Like many women, my guest this week has lived a lot of lives in one. Married and divorced in her 20s, Sarah Pimbra left a career in teaching, became a horror writer, and taught herself to scriptwrite. But it was when she turned her hand to psychological thrillers, age 44, remember that age, it's definitely significant, that things went a little nuts.
Our generation is definitely up for, you know, talking about what it's like to be in your 40s and 50s. I think we're much more open about it. Like my friends who are just coming into this period of their life, I'm like, oh God, your 40s are so great in so many ways.
That book, Behind Your Eyes, went on to sell over a million copies and is now coming to Netflix. Sarah is honestly the only person I've ever interviewed who has spoken so freely and frankly about money, how it changed her life in her mid-40s, and why it can vanish as quickly as it arrived. She made me realise that knowing your financial worth is quite rare, even in successful women, and we need to get a lot more comfortable talking about cash. So before I start prying into your personal life, Sarah, let's talk a bit about your career, because you've had a really interesting career path, haven't you?
Well, that's a really polite way of saying long. I did a lot of switching and swapping in my 20s. You know, I had quite a wild sort of time up until I was 25, and I was, you know, nightclubs and, you know, running restaurants and all kinds of very central London stuff. And then teaching I didn't do till I was 30. I did my teacher training at 29 because I had very foolishly got married in Las Vegas after a very short romance. And we ended up living in Devon and I was looking for a job, and it worked out that I could earn more money being paid by the government to train to be an English teacher than by working in an office full time. So I thought, well, I might as well, you know, do that and have an extra qualification. But I never actually intended to teach. But I did. I taught for 6 years. As jobs go, it's quite a fun job. But 6 years was enough. And then I became full-time writer after that. But I didn't quit to become a full-time writer. I took 6 months out because I didn't think I could afford to do it full-time. But then it just luckily all kind of came together and I stayed not teaching. So that was quite cool. I was writing 2 books a year for a while just to make a salary.
So tell me about, because you made your writing career sound like, oh, I just always did that and then it happened, and, you know, like completely doing it down like it was like no big thing. But, you know, you did write, like say, you wrote 2 books a year and you were writing horror and YA, so young adult, and SF. I mean, you were really like churning it out.
Yeah. I mean, Behind Rise was my 23rd book. First book came out in December 2004, and then Behind Rise came out January 2017. So in that period of time, 15 years, I guess. So yeah, pretty much 2 books a year. I think like most writers, just very afraid all the time and afraid of failure. And I just kind of just wanted to write stories. And I think when you're starting out, the advantage of not getting paid a lot is people let you write more freely. But I've sort of made it work eventually. It took a while, a lot of wine. But we got there in the end.
So tell me about Behind Her Eyes. We'll get to translating it for Netflix and all that. But tell me about how that happened, because it had its supernatural element, but it was quite different for you. What made you decide to
write that? It was a really interesting. It was a lesson in getting out there in a lot of ways, you know, going to festivals, going to conventions, going to book events, you know, when you're like a lesser known author, because I was at LongCon, which was the World Fantasy and Science Fiction thing. WorldCon? Yeah, they had it in the year too. It was massive. And I'd gone along and I was kind of in and out every day. And then Tasha Barden from HarperCollins was there. And we'd been friends for a while by this point, you know? And she said, I'm going out for dinner tonight with a couple of people. Do you want to come? And I was like, you know, I'm a bit tired. I think I might just head home. You know, I can get home for the day. I'm not staying overnight. And she went, well, do you want to have a coffee? So I was thinking, okay. Being a convention, we went for a beer. We didn't have a coffee. It was really a pivotal moment. Tasha basically said to me, we at HarperCollins don't think you're being published as well as you could be. So I said to her, well, you know, what kind of thing? And she said that fateful thing. She was like, well, just come up with something. It doesn't have to be brilliant. And I can take it to acquisitions, which of course means it has to be brilliant. Yeah. And it was a really awful week, actually, because I was in Chiswick looking after my friend's dog for a month. And I had to have the dog put down that week. And they were in LA, and then had to get all that sorted. And Graham Joyce, who was a writer, the fantastic kind of magical realism books, he died that week. He'd been ill for a while. So it was a really shitty week, really. And I remember walking up and down Chiswick High Road and thinking, I've got to come up with something. This is a massive opportunity and I've got nothing. And I mean I knew I wanted to write about an affair and kind of some relationship dynamics, because at that point in time I'd read Gone Girl, I was reading those kind of books, I was getting into that kind of psych thriller, I'd been reading this stuff, and I thought, well, I'd quite like to try something like that but then throw in something crazy along with it. So I wanted to write about dreams because I dream massively, but I had nothing. So I thought, right, I'm just going to go to the pub and have a glass of wine, which I did. And I got my notebook out and I had all the characters and who done what, and I wanted there to be a murder. And then suddenly I had the ending in my head. And then I thought, okay, this is interesting. And yeah, and where I was really, really lucky was HarperCollins couldn't pay me massively for that book. They literally paid me as much as they could for my previous sales, Justified. But it was not a lot of money, but they gave it the support as if they'd spent 150 200 grand on that book. You know, I'm not shy of saying what I earn. I earned 30 grand for that, 30 grand for Cross the Heart, with 20 grand in bonuses for paperback sales. It was an increase for me, but it wasn't life-changing money. And we didn't announce the deal at all. We sat on it until I'd written the book, and then it was time for Frankfurt Book Fair, I think it was, or London Book Fair, one of the book fairs. And they made this big announcement. Like, they made it sound like a massive book. And then the Americans paid a huge amount of money for it. It sold in 25 territories. Film rights sold really quick. I will forever be indebted. You know, as Tasha put it, which was really sweet, we would have loved to have paid you a fortune for it, but we couldn't justify it, so we just went with it as if we had, which I think was a really great moment for me.
Yeah, because you just said they didn't pay life-changing money, but you ended up getting paid life-changing money, didn't you?
It changed my life. I mean, and this is, again, I mean, this is comedy gold, because Behind Her Eyes came out in America. And when I gave in Cross Her Heart to the same publisher that had bought Behind Her Eyes, they'd only paid for one book and they had paid quite a lot of money for that book. So when I handed in the next one, they decided they didn't want it. It was too dark. So I was a bit like, oh my God, I've just shot myself in the foot. Maybe I should have written something a bit more romancy or whatever. And my agent in America, she is Irish, and she just went, listen, leave it with me. And so she went to like five or six editors who had wanted Behind Her Eyes and didn't get it. Said, you've got 3 days, read it, come in with an offer. And all I was thinking was, God, I hope someone offers me enough that I can walk away with my dignity intact. And so then she said, can you do a couple of calls? And I was like, yeah, all right. And I didn't think they were going to go anywhere. And then I had a really great call with William Morrow. I tried to ring her when I got off the phone and she was engaged. So I messaged her in sort of jokey, oh, you're obviously busy working, doing your actual job or something. But she'd been on the phone to David. I will never forget it. It was the weirdest night of my life. And she rang me back and she said, right, he's made an offer. And I was like, okay. She said, it's for 3 books. And I was like, okay. And she says, it's $1 million. And I literally was like, what? What? And I was like, we're going to take it, aren't we? We're going to take it. And she was like, no, I don't think so. And I was like, watch, because we can get some more. And I was like, oh my God. She went to other editors to find out what their maximum offer would be. And it came out very nearly 1.5. And then, of course, we did our new deal with England, which obviously was not near that money, but for England was also very good money.
So you are really strikingly candid about money. Of everybody I've spoken to, you're the most candid about it.
Well, when you get those big deals, they publish them in the press anyway. So people have a rough idea. I mean, I'll tell people how little I've earned for books as well. You know, like, I've, you know, written books for tiny amounts of money when I was starting out. But I think it's quite nice to know that you don't have to have your first book to get that big deal.
So, why do you think women are, in particular, are reluctant to talk about money, much more reluctant than men?
Well, I think we're in a lot of ways conditioned to feel embarrassed about any form of success to a certain extent, because that when men do it, I always think, does that mean you have a small dick that you're telling me how much you earn? So I do think we're conditioned somewhat to not be as bullish with our earnings as men are. You know, men take it as a badge of honour. I mean, whenever I talk about money, I come away from it feeling really embarrassed that I talked about it and thinking, oh my God, I must sound like such an idiot for talking about money. But I also think this is a business. And if you were going to go into any other business, you'd want to know what you could earn, or if someone was listening in. And
yeah, it's really interesting because I kind of often end up talking to people on social media about the fact that I'm endlessly asked to do things for nothing. Give me a bit of free advice, or, you know, the coffee and the chat.
Yeah, it's like we're supposed to be constantly nurturing other people. I don't mind doing it when people are starting out, but you reach a point when you think, hang on a second, I'm spending quite a lot of my time helping other people who then, if they are successful, quite a lot of them, you never hear from them again. I don't know, would men do that? I suppose some men do. Women have to fit their writing in amongst other things. And I do see it in male writers on Twitter that some of them have really bought into that kind of artist thing, whereas women are just like, yeah, knocked out 500 words between changing nappies and cooking a dinner. Men can be artists in garrets. Women are just authors. I mean, when I did have a live-in boyfriend, and to be fair, not always his fault per se, but it totally limited my time because, you know, there was a point when I was trying to finish something and I thought, God, if I was a man, I'd probably say, right, I'm going to go off for a few days. You know, the level I was getting paid for the book, it's, you know, it's the main breadwinner kind of thing. If I said, oh, I needed to go away for 4 days to write, if I was a man, someone would probably go, oh, yeah, go away, do it, it's fine. Because women are kind of automatically, how can I make the situation better? Whereas as a woman, you just have to carry on the sofa around the noise. But as you get older now, I'm much more demanding of what I need. Yeah, this is what I'm like. This is what you're going to get. You know, I need to see my friends. I need this. I need that. All the stuff that you give up so much of when you're younger for the sake of a man, lovely as they are.
Great. I also wanted to talk to you about being a female screenwriter and the way that women are portrayed on TV and in film. When you're writing a script, you know, nobody listening knows how that works. So tell us how that kind of, how female characters are described in scripts.
Well, you know, normally, as with all characters, people will put physical description in. And, you know, I realized from reading lots of sample scripts when I was starting out and other people's scripts, like a man will often be described as, he might be very handsome, but it might be more, you know, he's rugged, he knows what he wants in life, he's tough, he's this. A woman, stunningly beautiful, but doesn't know it. You know, that kind of thing. It's always perfect figure and also intelligent, that kind of stuff. And I was always like, well, there's many, many things that can go wrong there. If I was an actress reading a part, I'd want to know who the character is, you know, rather than, it doesn't matter if she's got perfect, lustrous, thick black hair, you know, over her sexy smile and, you know, perfect size 10 figure as she kicks ass around town. So now I just try and put, like, I'll give a rough age because that's often important, you know, depending, you know, on the character, if it's a young couple or whatever, you put the rough age. And then I'll put, like, she's slightly insecure, but she's got a great sense of humour, which she covers it with. Or something like, you know, I'll try and describe the character rather than her physicality. It's like that, you know, she's feisty, you know, she's strong and feisty. You think, what does that even mean? You know, like, she doesn't suffer fools gladly. That I'll take, because now I have that, you know. But feisty, I'm like, that's what someone writes just after they've said she's stunningly beautiful and feisty.
Feisty is one of those words, isn't it? It's like, in fact, someone else I've interviewed for this series talked about feisty as well as being the word that annoys them more than anything else.
Yeah, and it's always like a younger woman can be feisty. An older woman's just a bitch if she's feisty. If she's younger, she's sort of more perky, so she's allowed to be feisty. And feisty implies that it can be tamed, you know, which I don't like as well. So there's all kinds of connotations to a lot of the words that are used. You know, there's massively more character roles and great roles for women in their 60s and up. I still think Hollywood, and they don't know what to do with the 40 to 55 range, you know, because these days we're still out there doing stuff and I still think we're sexy, and, you know, I think you're sexy in our 70s, but, you know, they will cast a 25-year-old to be the girlfriend of a 55-year-old or a 30-year-old to be the girlfriend of a 55-year-old. I mean, even in real life, you know, if I know someone who's wealthy and successful and they're dating age appropriately, I just want to slap a gold star on them and go, well done. It's so reflective of, you know, it's like people who say they go on Tinder and, you know, the men of 50 are all looking for a 25-year-old, which is also pathetic, isn't it? The fastest way to make yourself feel old, I should imagine, is to go out with someone half your age. You know, I don't think it's going to make you feel any younger.
To say it's like we all wanted to give Keanu Reeves a medal, didn't we, for going out with
a woman,
that artist who's only 10 years younger than him.
Yeah. And she dyed her hair. And so she's clearly, you know, like, oh my God, she's so brave. She doesn't dye her hair. Like, it's so terrible to have grey hair. Casting is very much like that. I mean, we've talked before about The Undoing and Nicole Kidman and Hugh Grant and the dynamic, and even the younger woman, the woman he has the affair with. I'm like, really? I mean, like, Hugh Grant kissing that younger woman. And I never thought I would say the day that Hugh Grant kissing someone made me want to be a little bit sick. But I was just like, this man is really, you know, growing old gracefully or whatever. And then there's Nicole, plumped and fluffed, and because I suppose you have to be to a certain extent. You kind of hope that you would grow up, do it without any injections and fillers. But I guess in the roles that she wants to get and to stay in the visual eye, as it were, I guess, you know, she's made herself look 10 years younger and he looks 10 years older, and it's all right for him. People are now praising his acting skills because he's got creases, you know.
But it's exactly that, isn't it? Because I remember when I saw that casting, I thought, oh, that's great. That's brilliant. Is it like they're close to the same age? I mean, he's probably, what is he, 60? She's
about 52.
Early mid-50s.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of appropriate. And then you see all the publicity material and you're like, hang on, he looks like her granddad.
You know, they still managed to sneak in an inappropriate age gap.
You said, which I thought was quite interesting, like she has to do that for the parts she wants. But in that case, she was playing...
Yeah.
You know, a woman of roughly her age. And she has, not to A, criticize Nicole Kidman, because I think she's pretty amazing. Also, or to criticize anybody who, you know, wants to have work to keep looking how they look. But it was that real, there was that real sense of he's allowed to look like a 60-year-old bloke. He's not allowed to look like a 50-year-old woman.
And that's what I think. I think a lot of these actresses, you know, like, I mean, I have been there and said, oh my God, what has she done to her face? So many times. But actually, when your livelihood is dependent on your appearance, which for women it is so much so, you know, you either get stuck with being a character actor. I mean, a friend of mine, she played Mrs. Hughes in Downton Abbey. And a few years ago, we were in LA and, you know, people just kept coming up to me going, oh my God, you look so much better in real life. She's so old on screen. And she was like, do you know what? I literally just wore no makeup for that part. She said, you know, any 50-odd-year-old woman with no makeup on under studio lighting, you're going to look like shit or you're going to look older. But she had to do it to look, so she could play this safe older woman. But you're not allowed to be like a woman in your 50s and still leading an exciting life in TV land. You know, it just doesn't seem that way. So I could totally, you know, I try not to be judgmental, because we all have moments when we look in the mirror and think, oh my God, maybe a little injection in there would do me some good. But I also think that way lies danger. So I think it's very unfair in that he's almost celebrated for it. You know, I mean, I love you as well, so I'm not knocking him, but it's like, oh my gosh, you know, he's grown into this amazing actor because he's not playing the pretty boy parts anymore. But Nicole Kidman is a great actor, but she's not allowed to look like herself while being a great actor, you know, like, where's the
has to still, even if she's not playing pretty girl parts, she still has to look like a pretty girl,
even
woman.
I mean, she's still got to look like an astoundingly stunning woman. She can't just, you know, look like a normal woman. If a woman is not beautiful, she's the quirky side character in TV and film, you know, especially as they get older. You know, unless you're Drew Barrymore or Reese Witherspoon or Nicole Kidman, you know, and I think it's just unfair on real women. You can come away from stuff feeling really down about yourself if you're in the wrong mood when you're seeing all that stuff. You know, the disconnect between the men and the women and how they're supposed to be.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Do you feel more relaxed in yourself physically because you feel like you're not in that game anymore? You don't have to compete, or is it because you just feel more relaxed?
It's hard to say, isn't it? I do think there's something when you're over 40 that there's lots of things happen. Your body starts to change anyway. So you're so distracted by if and when you're having periods and feeling like shit and all that other stuff. I think you're aware that you're becoming older, which I think does make your tolerance of other people, men especially, you know, like I just want to cut through the bullshit. No fucker is sliding into my DMs anymore because I literally don't have time for that. You know, all the games and all that kind of stuff. And you just think, you know what, life is short. I just want to meet someone great. And if I want to have someone, I want them to be just a great, normal person. I think there is a realization that all that time competing with other women or feeling insecure from other women or constantly comparing yourself to other women is such wasted time. Because I think my best female friendships have come back from over 40 when we're all a bit like, what the fuck was that about? We actually like each other better than we like men in a lot of ways. It's hard to say. I think there's a combination of both things. I think mentally, you know yourself so much better in your 40s than you do in your 20s. And physically, physicality is not everything. Otherwise, everyone's screwed, aren't they? Nobody stays beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
Feminism is different in all different parts of the world, and we have different issues in all different parts of the world. But I do feel that women are uniting. I mean, you wouldn't always believe it if you looked on Twitter. But I do think women are uniting and realizing that actually the way forward is to just keep chipping away. Just keep chipping away. And I think talking about money is important for that. Talking about sex is important for that. You know, talking about other kinds of women's experience is important for that. But I definitely think that this is the time of the menopause. Our generation is definitely up for, you know, talking about what it's like to be in your 40s and 50s. I think we're much more open about it. Like my friends who are just coming into this period of their life, I'm like, oh God, your 40s are so great in so many ways. And in other ways, God, they're awful. You just don't know you're coming and going half the time, which is good. I think, you know, I think it's like in your book, you know, that anger fuels you, you know, it really does.
For me, the most difficult thing about menopause was the silence and that nobody talked about it. And I didn't really have a clue what was going on. And I didn't feel like I could just go. In fact, when I did kind of try and raise it a couple of times with friends, they were all a bit like, oh, no, get away, sign of the, you know, antichrist. Like it was catching.
You know, like you're suddenly not sexy, you're suddenly not a person, you're suddenly, whereas I'm kind of like, now I try and be loud about it because it's definitely affecting my mood. So I do think that is important that people know that, you know, if I'm snappy with someone on text, I'm like, oh God, I'm properly menopausey today, you know, month six, no period, or month five, no period, or whatever. So people can get, because it is a thing that your body's going through, and they can call it natural, but death is also natural. You know, like, it's not necessarily a pleasant period. So this may be a natural phase, and I'm hoping we will come out the other side of it happy and, you know, punch in the air. You know, I think it's really important that other women know that it's okay that you're having this, and you don't have to have HRT, or you can have HRT, you know, horses for courses. And because our mums just kind of sucked it up, didn't they? And it hangs over you like a cloud all the way through your life as a woman. It's like this terrible thing that happens, and then you die. And then someone said to me, actually, you have more years after your menopause than you had with periods as a rule. And I was like, oh, okay. So yeah. it's not this end game. I do quite like not panicking about fucking Tampax every 2 minutes.
I think how much money I've saved, because I used to have such heavy periods. I could get through bloody packets of them.
Yeah.
So when you wrote Behind Her Eyes, I know this is probably completely irrelevant, but you were 44 and Gillian Flynn was 44 when she wrote Gone Girl, and Paul Hawkins was 44. Do you think that there's a 40-something thing?
I think there's a massive thing. You know, my friends who are sort of a few years younger than me, they're all hitting that early 40s thing now. 40s are in many ways brilliant. I have really enjoyed my 40s in that I literally give so much less of a shit than I ever did before. You know, like, men I don't care about so much, as you can tell by my Zoom appearance. Yeah, and I think there is something that if you're a woman with children, which I'm not, but I've seen it in my friends, they start to regain themselves. They're kind of like, right, I'm ready to get back to being me again. And I think there is a sense of taking stock in your early 40s and thinking, right, enough dicking around. If I'm going to do this, let's really go for it. This weekend, I'm celebrating my 6 months without a period. So it's that constant, like, you know, like, and people keep saying, oh, you're only 48, you're too young. And I'm like, tell that to my freaking ovaries and my hot sweats.
See, I was 46 and it did feel like it was too young. But you
I
know.
Remember I missed my first entire period. It was the year of Behind Her Eyes. So 46. Someone said to me, it's about 3 years after your first missed period that it really kicks in. And I'm now at that 3 years. I'm going to be 49 in a couple of months. Men don't have that thing where you're suddenly checking when your last period was and why are my boobs sore all month and why all this stuff that women have to cope with and get irritated and, you know, fed up and pissed off. I think it kind of spurs us on a little bit. I think our midlife crisis is different to men's. Even as a single woman, you know, woman who's not married, no children, until you're sort of mid to late 30s, I think we're all quite submissive. Whether we're alpha women or not, we give in to other people because you kind of think, oh, it's easier life if we go along with what they want. I remember splitting up with a live-in boyfriend, and I'd kind of gone from live-in boyfriend to live-in boyfriend to live-in boyfriend. And I remember, such a stupid thing, but I had always wanted to try the Tesco's big and fresh eggs. You know those eggs? They were always the yellow box. They weren't even...
They weren't
free range or anything, but they just, to me, looked like, oh my God, they look like really big and tasty eggs. And he'd always, oh no, we get these eggs. And when we split up and I went to Tesco on my own for the first time, I was like, I'm having those bloody eggs. And they weren't even that great, but I had them, you know? So I think we suddenly become about ourselves a little bit. And I think other women become far more interesting to us because we stopped feeling so competitive with other women. You know, I think you reach a point where you're like, why have we spent all these years worrying about what other women are thinking of us? And I do think that in my 40s, I've become much more respectful of how hard my friends with kids had to work, because obviously I didn't have them, so I kind of just thought, oh, why have they changed? You know? But now I look at it and I think, oh wow, they were really holding it together there. So my current book I'm writing now is about a career woman who's got a stay-at-home husband, and the dynamics there start to unravel.
You can tell me to fuck off, but has your financial success affected your relationships at all?
It's difficult to say, isn't it? I mean, I was going out with Irvin Welsh for a while, and he's not at all, you know, he's not broke, is he? So that wasn't, you know, we'd be fighting to pay bills. So no, it didn't affect that one. My last live-in boyfriend, it took him a little while to adjust to earning less than me. But it was such a vast difference. That sounds awful. But you know, and you know what it's like in our job, it's feast or famine, isn't it? Which is why I don't have a massive great big house. I've just got a 3-bed semi because I think at least it's mine. There's no mortgage. I see a lot of people get money and they buy a massive house and you think, well, how many rooms do you need? You know? Yeah, it did. But in many ways for me, I don't think he saw it this way, but it was very freeing because I used to say, like, the great thing about living with someone who's got their own money, living with them or not living with them, whatever, if they're with you, they're simply there because they like you. You know, that I didn't need him for his money. I didn't need him for a house. I didn't need him for any of those things. So while I was there, it was because I liked to be there. But I think men aren't used to it being that way around.
No, exactly.
I mean, to be honest, I haven't really, I'm too busy hot flushing to think about dating. But, you know, like, and also I've reached that stage, which is awful, where you start feeling old and unattractive and the pandemic doesn't help because you don't really make any effort either, do you? Because it's not like you're seeing anyone.
No.
Yeah, it's just like nobody cares anymore. I do see some women out and about always looking nice. I think, God, I should at least try and make an effort. But that never seems to last. If I ever have another relationship, I think it would have to be with someone who was either very secure in themselves or had money of their own. It's just easier. And I'm quite happy to pay for stuff, but it doesn't always sit well with people, does it?
Has the pandemic completely nixed dating then?
I just can't bring myself to internet dates. My problem with internet dating is the people that I have actually been in love with in my life, I would never have chosen from an internet date picture. It's kind of two ways. The ones I would probably fall in love with, I probably wouldn't choose their picture. You know, they're probably people I think, oh, they're not very attractive, which is an awful thing to say, but that's how we all think. But I'd probably really like them face to face and think, oh, they're really funny. Because for me, it's funny, clever, witty, that kind of thing I like. But then if they're really good looking on there, I think, what is wrong with them? He must just be a player or something. So no, I'm not designed for internet dating. And aside from that, where are we going to meet anyone in the pandemic? It's just not going to happen.
Dog walking. I definitely think, like of a lot of the women I've spoken to, as they've gone into their late 40s and into their 50s and beyond, you're a bit less focused on, oh, I've got to do that thing or say that thing because that's what that person wants.
Yeah, totally. You're less likely to play other people's game, if you know what I mean. The other people's approval is not so important to me now. And even with other women, we still evaluate other women in the same way we evaluate men, but I evaluate other women in a much more gentle way now, I think. When you're in your 20s, you're kind of conditioned to want to be the funniest, the most attractive. We're all trying to be the pretty one in the room, which, you know, I was sort of 10 stone at 10, so that didn't happen for me at an early age. But so we're all trying to be either the funny one or the witty one or whatever. And we all look at other women and feel insecure about ourselves. But that's gone now because it's like, I'm nearly 50. That's not, you know, like, I'm just not going to be the prettiest woman in the room anymore. So let's just chill out and just get on with people. And you realize, actually, you know, what was all that time wasted? But I do think men have a role to play in that as well. You know, like, I think it's just centuries of conditioning. Even my mum to this day will say, oh, you know, if you meet a rich man and settle down, I'm a bit like, where's feminism and all of that? Meet a rich man. So what do you think I'm doing? I'm trying to be rich myself, Mum.
Yes. She's still saying that to you now.
She'll say, oh, it's a joke. I'm only joking. And I'm like, because it's true. She's only just got over me not going back into teaching. I think now it would take a very special man to make me actually want to live with someone again. It used to be quite important to me because everybody was in couples and it was kind of, you had to be in a couple. And now I'm like, no. That was one thing I liked about living in London, actually, was there was a huge swathe more single women of all ages. You know, we had my friend's husband's 60th birthday by Zoom a few weeks ago. And it was literally all couples' faces and then sort of just me and my book.
No one cares anymore
because I'm past childbearing. It's not that, oh, you've still got time thing that I used to get.
When did that stop?
I reckon about 42. Yeah.
I started to give up on you at that point.
Well, it's just random people, isn't it? It's like the dentist or whatever. Like, are you married? No. Boyfriend? No. Children? No. Oh, there's still time. And you're like, fuck off. Just drill my teeth.
It's like, when you think about it, isn't it? It's outrageous, yeah. Really. So, like, you don't even know me.
I know. And, you know, literally, a couple of friends of mine, Charlotte and Steve, like, Charlotte would be like, oh, it would be so nice if Sarah met someone. And her husband's like, Sarah's just driven with work. All Sarah wants to do is work. They've been married forever and they've got two beautiful kids and they're so perfectly happy. But so she wants that for me because that's what makes her happy. Whereas I just look at Gillian Flynn's career and think, oh, I'll have a bit of that. I think if I was a man, they'd just think, oh, Sarah, you know, Stephen, or whatever my name would be, you know, just very ambitious, you know, like, it's just an ambitious person. Yeah. Whereas when you're a woman, it's like, there must be something wrong with you, or you must be bitter, or you must have something. No, I really like men. I mean, I really like them. I like them a lot. But, you know, I'm not one of those women that has to have one, you know.
Yeah.
Not anymore.
Even now, there's still that sense that if you're a woman and you're our age and you don't have children, for example,
you've
somehow missed out.
Yeah. And people would be like, why don't you have a boyfriend? As if it's not a choice, but you know, you should have a boyfriend. Why don't you? As if like there's something so wrong. I'm not out there desperately crying, looking for a boyfriend. I'm literally quite happy on my own. You know, you meet people, you think, oh, that would be nice. But if it works, it works. If it doesn't, it's not the end of my world. I really just like making up stories. And since I've had a dog, I'm like, you know, the dog's pretty good company. The dog stays, the man can visit.
Fair enough. What's your emotional age?
I've had this conversation with people. Like, my mum always reckons she's still 21, which is bollocks. See, I think I'm maybe 34 emotionally, because by 34, I was writing, I was teaching. I was kind of in the zone where I still quite liked a night out, but I liked a nice dinner and a bottle of wine and good conversation. And, you know, and I think that that will be me probably through the rest of my years. I think my emotional age is probably the age I am now, because I do think even at 34, I was still contemplating perhaps if I met the right person having a baby, which was a flash in the pan thought. Because I'd lived with a man who had three small children. And when we broke up, I obviously really missed those children. I don't know. It's hard to say, isn't it? I'm definitely more jaded and world weary now. But I think that might just be the fucking pandemic, you know?
Yeah, cool. I just got a few questions that I always ask. Mm-hmm. So give me a book recommendation. What book would you push on a friend?
Oh, my God. Sarah Langan, Good Neighbours. It's about a close in New Jersey and all the families that live in it. And something happens to one of the kids, but it's a real kind of hysteria. It's got a sense of the crucible about it and gossip and that kind of thing. And it's a real step forward for her. I mean, she was always a really good writer, but it's kind of sort of literary domestic suspense, I guess, would be the way to describe it.
What advice would you give a younger woman?
I mean, it's also trite, isn't it? Try and be yourself as much as possible, because trying to be anybody else is really taxing, tiring, exhausting, and will just make you miserable. Image isn't everything. Men aren't everything. Don't ever, ever sacrifice your own goals for a man. That would be my... I think that's why women in their 40s are so ferocious, because they sacrifice so much for family, for man. And so often the men don't work out or whatever, and you've missed half a decade and you've realized you've set them up to go off and live their best life and you're carrying the can for it. So don't ever put a man's ambitions before your own. There will be another man, because there always is. You know, I see people who've been heartbroken in a divorce and then 5 years later they've met someone who makes them much happier. You know, and you're kind of like, that's the way the world works. But if you are an ambitious person, opportunities don't come along very often. You know, if you get an opportunity, don't sack it off for a man. So hard, isn't it? You know.
I think it's a really good bit of advice, though. Who's your old bird role model?
I don't know. Someone like Judi Dench or Joanna Lumley. When I'm old, I want to be still funny. You know, I'd quite like to be a travels with my aunt kind of old bird, you know? You know, I don't want to look like I'm trying to be a radical old bird. I just want to be a radical old bird. You know, yeah, those kind of women who still do what they want to do. Helen Mirren, she's not trying to be younger. It's almost like age is irrelevant. She's still getting on with what she wants to do. They're all still doing what they want to do and being who they want to be. And I think that is probably the best any of us can hope for when we're older.
What's your superpower?
I think I'm quite intuitive about my friends' feelings. You know, I'm quite good at spotting when someone's having a bit of an issue or that kind of thing. So, yeah. I don't think women believe their own hype in the same way men do. They think every word is a font of wisdom. I mean, not all men. There are nice ones. You know, I like a lot of them. But their attitude to things and success is different to women's, I think.
I kind of think it's more like if we're successful, we think it's a fluke. But if they're successful, they think, well, of course.
Yeah. And I'm getting better at that, actually, because I did have someone say something about imposter syndrome the other day. And they were like, do you have imposter syndrome? And I was like, no, I fucking don't. You know, I have worked hard at this for a lot of time.
It's like that Cheryl Strayed quote. She said something like, basically, I've worked really, really hard to be this lucky, you know.
Yeah. I think the pandemic has put a lot of things into perspective. I just want to do my own thing. I want to plow my own path. All that stuff that seemed so important a few years ago about the scene and people approving of you. I haven't got the energy, you know. I'm too busy trying to approve of myself without worrying about what other people think of me.
Yeah. It's a good point to ask you the last question. How many fucks do you give?
Oh, zero fucks. Even if I fall out with people now, if it's something that I feel was worth standing ground on, I'm a bit like, oh, well, you know, I'm just going to be sitting over here. Hot flushing in the fridge. I've just generally got grumpier, and it's an awful thing to say, but in a lot of ways, more blokey, I think. It's that kind of say what I think, got a lot of work on. got good friends and can live without the rest.
That's brilliant. Yeah.
You know, a good meal in a restaurant I could live with right now. A nice warm red on the go after a little pre-dinner cocktail, witty conversation, laughing, being silly, gorgeous food. That's my aim for this year, to be able to do that once. So we shall see. All right then, Melanie.
Cool. All right then. Thank you. Thank you for listening. I'd love to hear your feedback. You can reach me on Twitter at Sam Baker and Instagram at The Other Sam Baker using the hashtag The Shift. You can hear a new episode of The Shift each Tuesday on Acast, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what you hear, please do rate and subscribe, because it really does help other people find us.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.